is Jim Lundy, and this is a class on hypnosis. The first thing I would want to tell all of you, so you don't have to worry to the end, is you don't have to be hypnotized tonight. Not in any way, shape, or form. For those of you who may be interested, I will talk through a hypnotic induction at the end, but in no way do you have to go through that process. I know if I was attending a class like that, like this, I'd want to know that at the beginning. So that's for your information. I want to start by telling you a bit about why this topic. It seems a bit unrelated to some of the things of Holden, possibly. But I think hypnosis has to do with change when some of our more direct methods and attempts to change have failed. And in the church and in healthcare and in our faith walk, many of us spend enormous amounts of energy and effort on change. And understanding the brain a bit, and I'm certainly no expert on brain physiology, so if we have a physician in the group, please help me out. If we have a neuropsychologist in the group, please help me out. But understanding the brain and some of its functioning is very important, both in our roles as parents, leaders, teachers, guides, and in our own lives when we talk about change. So first of all, we're not talking about hypnosis as a technique. In my opinion, hypnotherapy clinics that exists to use the technique for the sake of achieving a quick change are missing the point. Just like if a person wants to eat any way they want and have any kind of blood chemistry they want and get a quadruple bypass surgery at 55 and keep on with their life, somehow that's missing the point. There's certainly a place for appropriate bypass surgery, but it isn't as a technique to fix things and then keep on living in certain ways. Neither is hypnosis just a technique or a fix. And so we want to put that aside to begin with today. But I would tell you that, you know, people who use hypnosis in entertainment and so on certainly are achieving something. I just don't think that's what we want to be focusing on tonight. Secondly, we want to look at hypnosis because we do acknowledge that willpower fails. We acknowledge that that head-on approach of change sometimes just doesn't work for us. And we can keep, you know, stirring ourselves up, grabbing ourselves from within and saying 100 times, I know I can do this, and we run into the same wall. And we want to see if we can find some other ways to get around that wall. Another reason to look at hypnosis is because, believe it or not, it respects your learning history. It respects all the things that your mind has stored and accumulated over the years and approaches change by respecting your history, not by trying to zap you. And so, you know, the anecdotal ideas of hypnosis are pretty inaccurate because the people you see hypnotized by nightclub entertainers and on TV and so on are a very special part of our population that's highly responsive to a certain kind of hypnosis, and that wouldn't include most of you. So the kind of hypnosis we're going to talk about is very respectful of who you are and where you've come from, and in fact that's why we talk about a back door, because we know the front door for you is pretty tightly locked, and I'll tell you what I mean by that in a bit. We also want to use the powerful other half of your brain. What makes you human, come on in and we'll try to make some room here. What makes us uniquely human is the cerebral cortex, or the higher part of your brain. I'm going to draw a really rough brain here. Okay, somebody's smiling. Yes, this is rough. That's my wife who's laughing. But we're going to call this your cerebral cortex. This is the part of your brain that does higher order reasoning. This is the part of your brain that does math, calculations, keeps you on time, can do abstractions, does language. This is the part of your brain that's just so wonderfully complex, and it's the, you know, it's the crowning glory of being human, is to have a cerebral cortex. The trouble is that this part of our brain can also learn things and, in a sense, not allow you to unlearn them. Have you ever had the experience of trying to talk yourself out of something that you felt? Let me give you an, if some of you are nodding, give me an illustration if you'd like to, or I'll give some.
Thinking about if there's something coming up and your gut feeling says don't do it, and you try to talk yourself out of listening to what's inside.
Mm-hmm. And even if you go through with it, how do you feel when you're there sometimes?
Like you made a mistake.
It's hard to talk yourself out of that feeling. You've all had the feeling of talking with someone who didn't feel worthy of God's love. You had that experience? What happened when you kept using logic on them? Did it work? Did more reasoning work? Yes? No. What did they say as you kept trying to reason them into changing their feelings? They would usually say, it's not for me. I know it's true, but it's for somebody else, right? They would say, I can't accept it for me, but I know it's true, and I know that feeling should happen for you. Well, what we know is that in the older part of our brain, and this is going to be real simplified, we'll just call this the old brain, your limbic system, if you're interested, the reticular activating system and so on, or complex, that is the part that's responsible for feeling. That's the part of your brain that could take a little boy and put a cape on him and tell him he can fly and put him up on the roof of a building and he might fly off. But he wouldn't fly. He'd crash. But what was happening is he saw possibility, but he didn't have good higher order reasoning. Now, what would happen after he did that first trip? Do you think you could get him up again? I hope not. And the reason you couldn't is because the information in the higher part of your brain, the higher order reasoning center, the cerebral cortex, would have a bit of information now, a principle connected that says you can't fly. Just don't try it. Now that's a simple illustration, but let's take some illustrations from your life and my life. What if we handed one of you a piece of chalk and said, come up here and spell a word that you don't know how to spell, or that you have a rough idea. On the way in tonight, I asked somebody how to spell a word. I knew there was one S or two S's and one P or two P, but I wasn't sure. Now, if I'd have done this up here, how do you think I'd have felt? Not good. And that would have become some learning information that would have got stored up here in my memory circuits that say, Jim can't spell. And so whenever I came to a spelling question, I would maybe be embarrassed to ask or not willing to let you know I don't know how. But this would be new information that's up here. Now, could I learn to spell? Probably. But if I get convinced at this level I can, this is going to have a lot of power. So what if? What if I try to quit smoking and fail? Or lose weight and fail? Or be less shy and fail? Or speak in public and fail, or do anything else and fail, what happens to us? We develop that same bit of information up here that goes in our computer that says, this isn't possible for you. And now let's turn our attention to the handout a minute and look through some of this. And then we'll come back to these ideas. First of all, a definition. Hypnosis is not sleep. Now, many of you, if you were going to allow yourself to be hypnotized and relax, and generalized relaxation is the first response in hypnosis, many of the adults in this room would fall fast asleep. I would, and in fact, it can happen in my office. When I hypnotize someone, I often start to yawn because I'm tired, and I do it enough that I relax instantly the minute I start an induction process because, you, in a sense, you get hypnotized yourself in the process. And for adults, we fall asleep. That doesn't mean that hypnosis is sleep at all. But if you're tired and you have a generalized relaxation response, you can fall asleep. And if that happens when you wake up, you're not hypnotized. But hypnosis is not sleep. It is a state of mind where portions of the brain are selectively focused, and we're thinking now more about the older brain is selectively focused, while other portions of the brain are partially ignored, meaning the cerebral cortex, your higher order reasoning. Okay? The part of the mind less focused is on the portion that handles critical higher order reasoning and stored data. The portion of the mind selectively attended to can then build in new conditioned responses based upon the new mindset. Now, this might seem contradictory to you, but I want to take the time to explain it. Hypnosis is considered a part of behavioral psychology. When you think of behavioral psychology, what do you think of? What comes to your mind, anybody?
Stimulus response.
Stimulus response, rats, reinforcement schedule. If you do this, I'll do this. Well, the reason that's worth knowing is that hypnosis is no mystery at all. It's no out-of-my-mind experience where I get new information magically put in, and I go to sleep and I wake up a totally new person. We're just really talking about a very, very complex but straightforward process of allowing you, allowing me, to make new learning connections. And what makes it so powerful is we're asking a part of our mind to kind of take a break. And what part of your mind are we asking to take a break? The critical part. The part that says you can't do it. Now, it doesn't say you can't do it like a critical parent. And we may talk about that later this week. It's not a hand of judgment that says you're not a good person. It's the critical part of your brain that's there from your own learning history that says, you know, don't you remember when you were 8 and you put that cape on and you jumped off the carport and you broke your leg? And, you know, it says you can't remember. You've had that experience. Now, let's take a minute, if you might, and talk about some safe areas in your life, because I'm not into you disclosing more intimate areas, but places in your or my life where in our learning history, we have learned that we're limited in an area that possibly isn't true. Anybody want to share a time in your life where you failed at something that left an effect on you, but probably you could succeed in that area if we could get past that failure?
Math ability.
Mm-hmm. Want to give us a little illustration?
I had a real hard time in math, and I had a teacher that made me leave the class, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after that, I figured I could learn it.
Right. Excellent example. Mm-hmm. Another one.
Volleyball.
Okay.
I just am terrified when people say, okay, now we're going to have a volleyball game. I just can't stand it. And
right.
I'm not as tall as
All right.
I mean, I don't think I'll ever be very good, but I probably could like.
Right. Right. Okay? Another example or two.
You know, public speaking is very hard for me, and I can't really remember a time when I actually failed it, but I lose my breath when I start. Once I get going, I'm okay, but that first couple minutes, I'm honest to God, I don't think I'm going to be able to get the first few words out, because I'm so afraid.
Right. Right. Good.
Listening to a concerto grosso, can't tell if it's in another group or the same group.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little more of that?
Okay, it's a form in music where instead of having one person playing the concerto, you have a group, mm-hmm. a smaller orchestra playing the group. So when the whole orchestra is playing, you can hear it. And then when the concerto grosso comes in, the small group mm-hmm. would sound just like mm-hmm. they got softer. Mm-hmm. And I had one awful time with that.
And you were criticized for not being able to make
right,
that distinction.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me just suggest a few things that most of you probably experienced anxiety in or limitations. Do you remember your first experiences in social settings where you were supposed to make a connection with an important person, a girl, a boy, an older classmate? Do you remember those experiences? Did they bring back good memories? The winces I'm seeing would not indicate that. No, usually we have bad experiences in that, and we feel limited, and again, these then put this general limitation on us when it comes to changing in key areas. And the other thing that we know is true is that we tend to fail in the same areas over and over and over in life, and we get stuck there, and that's again why hypnosis is an important idea, because the theory of the way the brain works in this would actually teach us that the more times you try and fail, the more certain it is that your next attempt is doomed. And that's why when we talk about change, the first thing is it's very important to give ourselves permission not to change, permission to change at our own pace. Because if I've tried and failed, and I come up again and I use the very same technique, it's most likely that I'm going to get the same results if I'm using the same computer to guide me through. So I'll bet some of you have had the experience of succeeding at changing and not believing it. Kibson, I heard some chuckles. Anybody? Mm-hmm.
I stopped fighting my training.
And how do you feel after achieving? You believe it. All right. Anybody change and doubt it? Have that experience? It's called the trampoline effect, where you change, but you really don't believe it's true. And the idea of a trampoline is that you jump up and down on the change to see if it really lasts. In other words, you lose a little weight, but you don't believe this is the real you, so you tempt yourself a lot. Or you quit smoking and you don't believe you can really stop, so you go back to the same behaviors that were the hardest for you to avoid smoking in. And what that is we're still haven't convinced our old brain that this is the new us. Okay, let's get a few myths out of the way. We've already said hypnosis is not related to sleep in any way. It's actually related to increasing the attention of one part of your mind asking the critical past of failure to just take a break. Just go rest for a while. Now, does that mean if you were deeply hypnotized and smelled smoke, you wouldn't immediately get up and leave the room? No, you would. Because your cerebral cortex, when it takes a break, it doesn't check out. It isn't anesthetized. If you found something dangerous going on, you could respond to that and take good care of yourself. Hypnosis is not related to intelligence. It's not related to IQ. Low IQ people are not more hypnotizable than high IQ people. It's just not related to it. But it depends more on the manner in which the subjects utilize their attention span, their ability to respond to vivid imagery, and their creativity. Let me do a little sample and measure this in the room. How many of you, let's take a beach scene. Now, in the beach scene, you're walking on the beach, you can feel the sand under your feet, you can hear the gulls in the waves, you can feel the wind in your face, and you can see the beach in front of you. How many of you can feel the temperature? How many of you can see it in your mind? How many of you can feel the wind on your face? Okay. How many of you can hear the goal? See, what are we doing? We're looking at your modality. In other words, some of you can see images in your mind. Some of you can feel the wind on your face. Others of you can hear the goal. Some of you who are really good at imagery maybe can do all of those and you won't even come back. You'll stay at the beach the rest of the time because it's hot in here and you've got a full stomach of dinner and that'd be a great place to be right now. But you see, it's important to do a little understanding of how your imagery works, because if you try to access your old brain through an image that doesn't work for your mind, it won't work. I've tried to hypnotize people by saying, you know, see your favorite place, relax, and after half hour we don't get anywhere, and they say, well, I can't see anything. And I go, oh, yeah, I should ask you. Can you hear the gulls? Oh, yeah, just great. So you need to work in the modality of hearing or feeling or movement. So you need to customize it to yourself. And it has to do with vivid imagery. When you're in the dentist chair, how many of you imagine you're somewhere else? Very healthy response. That's an alternate focus, which gives you just a touch of hypnosis. You know, what do kids do when they're terrified in the dentist chair? They over-focus on the dentist, don't they? The smells, the needle, the sound. See, they increase the part of the brain that you want to ask to take a break, and they don't access this part of the brain at all. So they do just the opposite of what they need to do. But that's natural for kids. You have the ability to take yourself away. Other times that you're hypnotized without knowing it might be when you're in a theater and there's a you have the experience of being there 2 or 3 hours by your watch, but feeling like you've only been there 1 hour. Or being in a theater and it was just a difficult movie to watch, and you feel like you were, felt like you were there 6 hours, and you're only there 1 hour. What you're getting there is time distortion. And when time alters from the normal passage of time, you've partially hypnotize yourself by asking part of your brain to just take a little break. It also happens when you do monotonous routine activities like driving down the freeway. And you've all had that experience of not remembering the last 10 miles, but you were a very alert, confident driver. Your mind just took a break from some of its higher order reasoning. Okay. And your kids better not say they had that experience driving, right? Okay, this is important, this bit of information here. It's estimated that by the age of 50, the brain contains 70 trillion bits of information or memories. These bits of information marvelously guide you. You wouldn't want to not have them. They're your resources for language, for driving, for cooking, for culture, for all of your mannerisms. They're your automatic pilot that you've taken all these years to build in. You desperately don't want to dismiss these 70 trillion bits of information. You've worked hard to get them. But they also limit you because they tell you what you cannot do. And that's very useful when it comes to little boys playing Superman, because they learn to not do that. But it's very distracting and sometimes critical for those of us who might want to learn math if we were told by a math teacher we can't, or to change a habit or a behavior that we now believe is true about us. Okay? Let's stop and take some questions and interaction before we go any further.
Concerning the higher order, you say it takes a siesta, but it's really alert to the dangers. For example, if we're in the presence of a hypnotist who tells us to do things that are against our moral judgment, that part of the brain would still be alert to that.
You know, I'm gonna give a qualifier, and if somebody asked that, I was gonna do that. Because we have to deal with reality. And part of the reality is we know that people are sexually abused under hypnosis. And I could give several cases of people who've been sexually abused while their dentist or physician hypnotized them. What went on in that induction was that the person doing the induction told the person that in fact they would have power over them and that they would not remember what happened. Now that didn't have to overpower the person. But for some of us who come in a weakened state, not feeling that we have a lot of personal power, feeling that this other person has a great deal of power, we submit to that direction, just like we might submit to another powerful person's order to do something that we didn't believe in, but we felt like we had to capitulate to and then keep secret. So there are clearly reported cases of sexual and physical abuse of people under hypnosis. I don't think it's the hypnosis itself that does it as much as the interpersonal dynamic and the personal variable. But you're right, that happens. I don't believe that same person would not respond to fire if they smelled smoke. I think they would come out of their trance and leave. A side issue of this that I don't want to go into unless you do is that hypnosis is used a great deal in the occult and in negative brainwashing and abuse. But it's not used at all in the way we're talking about. It's used by after physically and sexually abusing people. It's used after altering their consciousness with drugs. And I can tell you there's just no doubt about it from the police reports that we work with and the clients we work with that there's serious, serious misuse of hypnosis and mind washing by the occult and the satanic community in this country. And we're pretty familiar with that in Portland. We have 10% of the covens in the U.S. in Portland. And so we get the victims of those into our practice. And we have to dehypnotize them as a course of the treatment. And that's not a one-time process. But you're right, it can be abusive.
So whatever our moral standards are, or ethical standards, if they are strong, a hypnotist could not get us across the line.
Yes. Uh-huh. I would say that's true. With all those earlier qualifications. Mm-hmm. For an intact person who has a good sense about who they are, they're not going to be hypnotized into violating their moral or ethical code.
If you have been hypnotized and you found, I've got a hypnosis tape, and a lot of times I do fall asleep. You know, mm-hmm. the hypnotic suggestions that are coming through on the tape, if I've fallen asleep, it's like, this probably didn't work, I should do it again. I never worried about it. I just figured I was getting something out of it.
Well, there's some controversy about that. My opinion would be that when you fall asleep, you're not processing in the same way, and that you couldn't take in post-hypnotic suggestions. But many hypnotic tapes work for putting us to sleep because the suggestion is to go to sleep. And so it allows you to go to sleep.
Well, this one just says relax, and I guess I overdo it or something.
No, you're like all of us. You're ready to go to sleep, and if you're ready to go to sleep, hypnosis allows such a relaxation response as a part of the hypnotic induction that we do go to sleep. If you were to do self-hypnosis first thing in the morning, you actually find that you're more alert and relaxed, but that you don't fall asleep. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with falling asleep, but that isn't the hypnotic experience. More questions?
Is a hypnotist able to convince you through hypnotism that he is, in truth, someone else that you would be sexually active with, and thereby gain access?
You see, these are really good questions. I came prepared to talk about good people doing it. But hypnosis is another form of human interaction. And it's fairly intimate in that you're typically alone with a person. And sometimes you're asked to close your eyes. You're usually asked to relax. You go into some state of trust. And so in that interpersonal dynamic, a person might say, you know, start being interested in me. I don't think for a person who has a real intact sense of who they am or an I-ness that they would respond to that more than if the person said more up front, you know, do you want to go have coffee or to a movie or on a date or whatever. But there is an intimacy that's already been set by setting the stage. And you know, don't you, from conversations that a conversation over breakfast with the same person can be very different than having been on a train for 15 hours and still being 7 hours from your destination and you're in the lounge having a cup of coffee at 11 at night with that same person, right? There's a different dynamic, isn't there? You're exhausted, you're more vulnerable, you let your defenses down, you're a little more needy. So in that sense, the hypnotic experience could set you up.
They had had kind of the convulsions previous to 2 years of age, fever tremors type things. Mm-hmm. Is that common? And will that always happen if you had infantile convulsions?
It's not common. I've certainly heard of that happening. I've only had a few experiences like that. And let me talk just a bit about that if you're interested. One of the things, if we think about a brain that has all of these connections between neurons, we think, and this is some recent research now out of the Mental Research Institute at Stanford. And one of their ideas right now is that the brain has neurons that hold the emotional energy. And I'm just going to put X's in here to symbolize that for you. But this is the point of memory and emotional excitation. And that if somebody taps that, it hits a hot point in your old memories. And that underneath that are many other experiences that go with it that can be triggered at once. Now let's see if we can do this in a simple illustration way. Take a moment and think about being in grade school. And think about the kitchen in your home. And now if somebody wants to, tell us. So what we did was we picked a focal point, a bit of information. Being in elementary school in your kitchen. What else came up to mind?
Smell?
Polished floor. The people. Okay. See, so, but I didn't suggest that, did I? So what happened? And you weren't sitting here thinking about polished floors and smells in kitchens, probably. We tapped this, and it automatically went down and accessed neuronal connections that are there. It's part of your 70 trillion bits of information. Okay? Now, what she's talking about is, what happens if you access a bad one? Well, if you access a bad one, you can get the bad stuff that goes with it, including the mental memories and the emotional or sensation response, like smell is a sensation. And that happens when we do age regression hypnosis, which isn't something we're going to talk a lot about. But if you have reason to go back and try to remember something, then this is what you're doing. Okay? Good question. Other questions?
Just one more. Considering a person who's sound asleep, falls asleep, listening to music or listening to a classical radio program, to what degree can that radio or that sensitize or hypnotize you? And secondly, subliminal is that directing also at this old brain concept?
I can speak something about it, but I don't know good answers to your question. Subliminal advertising does affect us. It's illegal in some states because it definitely does affect us.
Well, what about the sleep concept? I fall asleep and all this stuff comes across the radio.
Well, we know that during surgery, that if there's negative talk during the surgery process, there's been clear studies that show that that affects recovery. If the team stands around and says, you know, this person doesn't have a chance, look at this mess. And that used to be done. The ethics in surgery have changed a lot with this. And now there's patients who elect to have people talk healing messages to them during the anesthetic. But you see, what's happening under anesthetic is different than sleep. And so I would say that the old brain is not accessible during sleep in the way that we're talking about during hypnosis. And other than that, I really can't answer the question. Not well.
Mm-hmm. How about is self-hypnosis, and is it effective?
We're going to get to that. It's very useful. And the reason that we give it up is the reason most Americans give up change process. It takes a lot longer than being hypnotized by somebody else, but it's infinitely less expensive. So it's something that is worth learning to do. I guess money matters at Holden. Yeah, we're going to get to auto-hypnosis because being able to do it for yourself is very, very important. And it's a good technique. Okay. Let's talk a bit about how the process works, actually hypnotizing somebody. And in a sense, what I want to do is just talk to you the way I would someone that I was going to hypnotize. And but I'm not going to do it in a way for you to even participate at this point, so we can stop and ask questions and talk about it. But I would say to someone that you've tried to change in this area in lots of times in your life, and you've used good techniques, and they were techniques that worked for your friends, so they should have worked for you, except they didn't work for you. So you kept trying them over and over and over. Much like taking a child who's having difficulty going to bed. Some of you, like us, have had children that could do World War II at bedtime. And you used all the techniques that other good parents used, and it didn't work on your kids. And so you felt like the solution was to bring in more power and to threaten them or to spank them or to raise the ante. But maybe they even were willing to raise the ante back. And it left you very frustrated. And then you watched a parent come along and say to a very stubborn child, do you want to go to bed in 10 minutes or do you want to wait until after your brother's through in the bathroom? And the child scratches his head and says, oh, I think I'll wait till my brother's through in the bathroom. And it was too easy. And what had happened was that that child was tricked, in a sense, but I mean that in the best sense of the word, into making a choice that wasn't a choice. They were given an alternative that was going to work out one way or the other. I mean, when you're in a three-hour war over bedtime, who cares about 10 minutes? And so if the child can elect to go now or in 10 minutes, that's inconsequential. If you could give yourself permission to quit smoking next week or in 2 weeks, would that be a big difference since you've tried for 15 years? No, it wouldn't. But what it does is it gives you the illusion of choice. It takes that critical failure part of the brain with all the bits of information and says, you know, you can just take a break. We're going to look at some new possibilities. And that's really what hypnosis is. It's giving you a chance to look at some new possibilities and leave some of the misery of your failure experiences behind. Hypnosis is not a lot different than the first time you went away to college and got that lousy dorm room next to the train that went by three times at night. And the first week you were there, you thought you were never going to get any studying done and that you'd flunk out of college. But after 3 months, you didn't even know there was a train there. And when a new kid moved into the dorm and complained, you were a little surprised. It's a little bit like your grandmother's garden, where she would plant it and you would go out and look at it every day and wonder if it was going to grow, and then you quit noticing it, and by the end of the summer, there was wonderful corn and tomatoes to eat. You didn't look at it every day, and all of a sudden, it was completed. That's really what hypnosis is. It's a way around some of your failures into some possibilities that are very, very possible for you. So it's not magic. We're going to access the very things about you that are true, that you can do math, that you can speak in public, that you can stop those habits, that you can be less reactive to those kinds of irritations. You can begin to make those changes. All the power is in you. None of the power is in the hypnotist. None at all. It's not about your intelligence. It's not about how fast you do it. It's not about how well you do it. It's an opportunity for you to change the way you see yourself and to let some things that have always been true about you come to the foreground. Things that are special and wonderful and ought to be evidenced in your life as you want it. How do you feel, and what kinds of questions might you have about that?
Mm-hmm. How does hypnosis work where it draws up memories that maybe through traumatic experiences that we haven't been able to, particularly like in police cases where they use hypnosis?
Okay, that's age regression and forensic hypnosis, and I'll come specifically back to those if there's no questions about that in that pre-hypnosis talk. How do you feel? Do you feel comfortable or tense, or do you feel like you have the power?
Mm-hmm. Don't you think, though, that surely I can spell, I can do math and all that, but you aren't always... Some people are much better at one thing than another. Mm-hmm. And I don't think hypnosis would ever make me be a good spell. I can do anything in math. But uh-huh.
No. Hypnosis, if you don't have a capability, hypnosis will not give you the capability. But if you do have it, and it got limited by failure experiences, it can help release it to be true in your life today.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. I have experienced people who feel they can't carry a tune because their first grade teacher told them, mm-hmm. Billy, you can't carry a tune. You had better be a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that kid grew up with the idea, well, he couldn't carry a tune. Is there a way that hypnosis could show him that he can carry a tune?
Sure. That would be a good use of hypnosis. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And we'll keep talking about it and see if you can apply the use of it to that.
Doesn't there have to be, though, also a willingness on the part of the person to change? You must get clients that come in and say, you know, change me.
Right.
But they're not really willing, and... hypnosis would not work for someone in that case, would it?
Right, and we talked about hypnosis is not a technique to fix me like a pill. And so the two most common reasons where hypnosis would fail in that case is if somebody's, typically their spouse, sent them in to change. Or secondly, they came in but weren't sold on change and wondered if you could overpower their will, which you can't do at all, and it would fail. Let me talk a bit about age regression. Age regression and hypnosis is a process, as we said earlier, under extreme relaxation and alternate focus, meaning that the higher order reasoning is taking a little break, and we go back through the age memories, and you did that when you went back at 10 and noticed your kitchen. And then you hit areas that have been repressed consciously. And this is an area that you don't want to fool around in, because they can tell you that you can't bring up something that a person isn't ready to remember. I've seen it done. I've seen people have psychotic breaks under hypnosis by remembering abuse that they'd blocked out. And that patient hadn't made a contract that they wanted to take that risk. So there's a problem there. But what it does is it allows you to leave some of the defenses behind and go back and access memories. Now, forensic hypnosis is a little different. When forensic hypnosis is used to increase your awareness of a crime scene or the last time you saw a person, it doesn't magically bring back something that isn't there. It allows you to attend more carefully to what you already saw and remember. And there's no way hypnosis is used to hypnotize a person to see if they did or didn't do a crime. What you do, if you want to know if a person did or didn't do a crime, is use a polygraph. And although that's illegal, and it's in many states, and it's not admissible evidence, that's much better way to find out if person is telling the truth in hypnosis. Anybody can lie under hypnosis and fool any hypnotherapist. It's not a truth serum in any sense of the word. But if you were convinced it was, you might tell the truth, just as we were talking about being overpowered. But a real healthy, intact I would still lie under hypnosis and fool the hypnotherapist if they chose to. Now, there's another whole method of fixing these old memories called rapid eye movement, which Stanford is developing now, which is just the opposite of hypnosis. And if you're interested in that, I'll talk to you about it privately. But hypnosis is about relaxing in terms of age regression and putting some of the defenses aside and letting old things come up when we're ready. It should always be a part of a therapy process, not a fix. It's not a fix. It's not a technique. It's a part of an ongoing process. Okay, other questions or comments?
Alternate question to see how you'll handle it. A girl told me this, came to my office, and she said when I was in kindergarten, they asked me what my father's name was. I said his name was Perky. And all the kids laughed. She didn't speak really out in public until she was in sixth grade. She gained confidence to read something, and she read the word nowhere, now here. They laughed again, and she didn't speak out in public until she was 36 years old. My point is, you hypnotize, or is it conditioned reflex to say you can do it? How would you handle it?
Anybody want to respond to that? I'll be glad to, but anybody? So she had three experiences, two experiences, and was silent the rest of that time? I would think that the use of hypnosis would be a simplistic response to that kind of hurt. That I think something else in her own self-formation is being, well, her self-formation is so damaged and impinged in the process that the idea that you could just hypnotize her as a fix is a mistake.
But could you go back to those two experiences and under hypnosis talk about it?
Rework them, yeah. And that would be a viable therapy modality. But what we're doing when we rework it now is therapy under hypnosis, not just the hypnosis fix. It's not just taking her back and saying, oh, it didn't happen. It's actually taking her back. And this is where hypnosis and religion really has some nice connections, because you take people back to very traumatic, very terrible times in their life, or mildly terrible, and you can introduce the spirit of Jesus as a nurturer, as a healer. And you know, when you talk to a person who's been hurt in childhood, they often, in their cerebral cortex, are pretty mad at God. Why? You had the power, you didn't use it, didn't happen to my sister, didn't happen to my brother. Under hypnosis, there's less critical reasoning and more availability to accept the nurturing of Jesus. So when a person is remembering being sick and hurt, they can almost always let the person of Jesus, although interestingly enough, sometimes you have to let it be a woman Jesus because they aren't interested in men Jesus images, come into their life and nurture them. So there is that reworking. Good question. Okay. Anything else?
Yes, another question. Is it legal in every state to hypnotize if you have that power? For example, if I'm counseling and I have the ability to hypnotize people, is that against the law?
In some states, and I can't tell you which and how. In Oregon, anybody can hypnotize. In California, it's controlled to some degree, but I'm not current on how much. We did a little experiment in Oregon. Stanley Abrams, who was chairman of the Oregon Psychological Association at that time, I think, and a forensic hypnotherapist and a very fine man, called one of the hypnotherapy centers and described the symptoms of a terminal physical illness and said, can you fix it? And they said, sure, come on in. The trouble with hypnosis centers not run by credentialed people is they're into removing symptoms without understanding them. You don't want to hypnotize away physical pain unless you understand that it isn't related to physical illness. You don't want to reduce back pain sensitivity if you have a bad back and need to leave it alone. Although you could do that if you're a person who's highly susceptible to alternate focus. There's videos you can watch of women having cesarean sections without anesthetic under hypnosis. And certainly lots of dental procedures are done without anesthetic. But that's on your paper under the 30% rule. And the 30% rule is this, that hypnosis works great for 30% of the population and not so great for the rest. And that's true of many treatment modalities. So occasionally someone will come in for weight loss hypnosis and they'll lose weight and keep it off years later, but that's a real small sample. I got lucky when I first started doing hypnosis and had some very responsive clients and thought I was very good. I found out I had very good clients who responded to that modality, and my success rate dropped dramatically as the numbers increased. And you'll also find that people who are more interested in being hypnotized are often more responsive, and so it made some sense that people who are waiting, knocking on the door would do better than those you sort of talked into it. Okay, let's do a little bit just about, go ahead.
I had a question. Is hypnosis something that's relatively easy to learn to do? Would it be beneficial or maybe dangerous to practice it on friends or someone else? I mean, that's something that, you know, you stick with it. I mean, you talk about self-hypnosis, it's like, well, you can do it to yourself.
You know, if I had to give you a number, I'd say hypnosis is 95% safe to do on yourself and anybody else. The trouble is 5% of the population is going to have a serious abuse memory they've repressed. And, you know, with 50%+ of the women in our culture and, you know, 20 to 40% of the men being sexually abused, there's some pretty heavy memories out there that aren't fully surfaced to consciousness. You know, 95% of the time you could fool around with this and have no problem. 5% of the time somebody may recover a memory that they aren't prepared for, and that would be a problem. The rule is simply this. Don't go past what you're comfortable with. Don't make suggestions that aren't serious, significant, important, and reasonable. You know, use it respectfully. Let's take just a few minutes before we're out of time and talk about how you do hypnotic induction. Just a real simple one. Very simple one. And I'm going to speed it up. I would do this talk in about 15 minutes with a person. But what you want to do is you want to get what's called an ideomotor response. And that just means an automatic motor response of eyelid movement, hand movement, breathing change. And when you begin to get that, you're going to begin to relax in a way that you can make hypnotic suggestions to the old brain and just ask that higher order reasoning to take a little vacation. So a real common way to do it would just be to ask a person to sit in a chair, look up at the ceiling, and begin to notice that their eyelids are going to blink. Well, their eyelids are going to blink, even if it takes 10 minutes. But what happens as they begin to do that is they're saying, yes, I want to be a part of this. And then you'll find that your eyelids blink more and more and more and more. And as they do that, they get a little heavy. And they'll get heavier and heavier. And in a moment, they'll close. And that'll be the moment you choose. And I'm going to count to five. And it may be that five is the moment you choose. And by the way, it usually is. And that isn't power. And it's not a game. It's a process of me and another person in a fairly intimate connection saying, let's take a moment and look at some of your possibilities and put some of the restrictions behind. And usually the person's eyelids will close. And you can do this for yourself very easily. You can just sit in a chair. And what happens when you look up is that your eyelids automatically want to blink and they begin to feel heavy as a natural physiological response. You can also tell a person to put their hands in their lap and to press down on them and to feel the texture of your jeans. And you haven't noticed that all day, so that's a new thing to focus on. And in just a moment, one of your fingers is going to move. And as it begins to move, you're going to find that it wants to move more. And in a bit, it'll begin to move off of your lap. And in a bit, it'll feel like there's a hot air balloon tied to it. And it's just going to gently rise up to the ceiling. And if we did that tonight as a group, and I promised you I wouldn't do that to you, and I'm not going to, that we would find that fully half of the group would very easily go into that experience, if that was your contract when you came in the room, that you wanted to have a hypnotic induction. That begins the process then of allowing access to what we call the back door of the brain, where we can suggest some things are going to happen that haven't happened to you for a while. And in that process, we open up some new learning, new associations. And you see, you're very relaxed. And so now when we talk about doing math or public speaking or asking a boy or a girl for some time or being different with your kids or some other things, you have the possibility to connect relaxation, positive emotions with this new possibility. And remember, you've all tried to control your emotional system by willpower. I remember when I started preaching, I'd just shake in front of people. I'd promise myself I wasn't going to do it. I'd grab onto the pulpit. I'd shake the whole pulpit. No amount of effort would ever cause that to relax. But what we can do is we can go in the back door and ask this old part of the brain, which controls all those feelings, to take over and give us a new connection, and it can do it. And so under auto-hypnosis, what you do is you just do this over and over and over. And sometimes it takes 7, 14, 21 days of practice for it to come in. For other people who are highly susceptible and responsive to vivid imagery, one practice can unhook previously hooked together failure responses. Well, we're about out of time. Maybe one question and we'll adjourn.
How do you give yourself your own suggestions? I mean, I can see how you can make yourself relax, but how do you go about after you've relaxed?
You can make yourself a page. Okay. You'll find that as you do it, though, you don't. It isn't like your mind checks out. You know, you think ahead of time about what you want to be telling yourself, and you begin to go into this process, and you should remember
it. It should be daily?
It depends on the person. If you're, for many people, in the mid-range, they need to do it several times. For other people who are highly susceptible to hypnosis, it just takes one or two times. Any of you do dentistry under hypnosis? None of you? Okay. Have had oral work done?
Is it ever allowed to have a safeguard person with you? Say if you wanted to have someone you really trusted to not be under hypnosis.
Absolutely.
Present when you are being hypnotized.
You know, I would think if the person that was working with you didn't allow that, that'd be a point of checking out for me. The other thing you should know is that you just about cannot hypnotize your husband or wife. That the interpersonal dynamic makes it impossible. He or she will just laugh. Thank you very much.
No, I know, but I'll just tell you that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think the best thing I can do is to take that and everybody.